Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome. There's been a lot of talk in the air, on the airwaves, scuttling about that America could be going to war with Iran. Will that happen? We've seen a lot happening in the last few weeks. Of course, much of this is over whether or not Iran is, in effect, trying to build nuclear weapons, and the arguments sway about that. Iran is now just sentenced to death an Iranian-American, a former Marine, who says he was spying for the CIA. Iran just finished major military exercises on the borders of Afghanistan, the Strait of Hormuz. America, of course, just is beginning these exercises with Israel, the largest ever with Israel, that many see as a war sign with the United States, with Iran. And ironically, the United States Navy rescued Iranian fishermen being held by Somalian pirates. So it is all over. And the question is, what will this lead to, and where are we with all of this, and where should we be with all of this? We are joined in studio here by Charles Faddis. Sam Faddis is a retired CIA operations officer who served 20 years in the Middle East, South Asia, and Southern Europe. His most recent book is Codename Aphrodite. He is president of the Orion Strategic Services based near Annapolis, Maryland. David Swanson joins us by phone. His most recent book is War is a Lie. He's also the author of Daybreak, Undoing the Imperial Presidency and Forming a More Perfect Union. And Reza Marashi is research director for the National Iranian American Council. And Sam, David, and Reza, welcome. Good to have you all with us.
Thank you.
And the lines are open at 410-319-8888, 410-319-8888, to join in on this conversation. Given the tensions that exist in the world, let me just ask an overarching question from the three of you. Given the administration that we have here and its pronouncements about Iran, given the Iranian government and the state of that government, given Israel and our relationships with Israel over these issues, is there room for dialogue between Iran and the United States, or are we past that and playing games to either avoid or lead up to war? And let me start with David Swanson. We'll go to Reza Marashi and then to Sam Faddis. David? Hi, we have David on the line with us? Pot him up? Okay. Reza, are you there? All right, let's see if we can get this fixed. We'll start with Sam Faddis because you're in the studio. I can see you.
Okay. I would love to think that there is room for us to have dialogue with the Iranians, because obviously I think that's the way we ought to look to be resolving any international problems first. I don't think right now, currently, we're going to get much in the way of progress by talking to the Iranians. I think... You know, I don't know if we're past that in the sense that we can never get back to that point, or we can never return to dialogue. But I think that currently we're at the point where we need to be exerting pressure of some kind to modify their behavior before there's much to talk about.
But and I guess when David and Reza join us, and David and Reza, if you are within listening and you can hear us over the lines here, just say I'm here and we'll turn right to you right away, or the producers will tell me you're there. And I'll be here, 410-319-8888. Reza, are you there?
I'm here.
Oh, Reza, welcome. Good to have you with us. And David, are you there too now? Well, Reza, let me ask you the same question I asked that Sam Faddis just answered, which is, given the present political situation, do you think that there realistically is room for dialogue between Iran and the United States and the West?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's always room for dialogue. The question isn't whether or not there's room for dialogue. The question is, why isn't dialogue happening at a given time? Because at the end of the day, the tools of statecraft are very simple. It doesn't matter if it's Iran, the United States, or any other two countries. You have diplomacy and you have war. And anything that happens between diplomacy and war, whether it's sanctions or containment policies, secret assassinations, computer viruses, you name it, it's really just a stalling tactic that kicks the can down the road to avoid the inevitable choice between these two options. The inconvenient truth is, you know, every conflict, every war ends via negotiations. And so anything that happens before war, if that's the direction you're going in, is simply for leverage. So what are we doing right now? If we're not at war with Iran and we're not talking to them, we're trying to build up leverage. So there comes a point in time when either, you know, the lack of communication and the misperceptions and the miscalculations between the United States and Iran spiral into a conflict that neither side particularly wants, or we're trying to build up leverage for a point in time in maybe the not so distant future, we do talk. But even then, you know, diplomacy hasn't been sustained in any kind of fashion, and that's the responsibility of decision makers in both Washington and Tehran. So it's going to take some very brave people, both in Washington and Tehran, to take a stand for peace, and I hope the adults in the room do exactly that.
David, you with us?
Hey, how are you?
Good, well, welcome. Good to have you with us, as usual. So tell us your take on whether or not there is a chance for negotiations at all between Iran and the United States and the West, given where we are at the moment.
Well, of course there is a chance, and there's a legal chance until Congress bans speaking to Iran for the U.S. government and U.S. military, which seems to be on the table. But, you know, the chance diminishes because these things acquire their own momentum, and as offense leads to retaliation and exercise leads to actual intimidation, there's a chance of a full scale of a major war getting underway, despite many people wishing otherwise. And when you've apparently got the United States and Israel blowing things up, funding groups, murdering scientists, holding exercises, making threats, and Iran beginning to make threats as well, it's getting dangerous.
So I wonder if, when you hear the sabers of war being rattled, which we're hearing on all sides, I mean, we hear it in Iran from the side of the government in Tehran, we hear it from Washington, D.C., you hear it all over, you definitely hear it in Tel Aviv and in Israel, pushing almost actually for a war with Iran, it seems, in their foreign policy. I mean, is this an inevitable spiral down to this? I mean, is there any way that any of you see of backing away and creating an air, a place where peace can be assured and that a dialogue can take place? Or have we gotten beyond that point? Some people argue we've gotten beyond that point. Sam?
I don't think that I'm so pessimistic that I would say that it is we're definitely beyond that, that we're on some slippery slope, we can't go back, and that war is inevitable. So I would not subscribe to that at this point in time. I still have some reasonable hope that we can make the Iranians modify their behavior. I think we have, to use a term that was used by one of the other guests, until we have such sufficient leverage to force that modification of behavior, I don't think there's much room to discuss now where we are. I do believe, however, having said all of that, there is significant possibility that we're going to find ourselves in a war with the Iranians, and for the kind of reasons that, unfortunately, a lot of wars start, which is not that somebody made a decision that we're going to go forward to it, that we stumble into it, that things get out of control, and the next thing you know, we're in a shooting conflict with the Iranians.
Could I suggest something?
Reza, go ahead, please.
I wonder if wars don't get started because of underlying world views that it is the privilege of one powerful nation to go start a war or threaten a war to alter someone else's behavior. And I would wonder what that behavior is whose alteration justifies bombing and killing large numbers of people. Iran, as far as anyone knows, is in compliance with the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty, in stark contrast with the United States. What is the behavior that we have the right to go and alter and to threaten war in order to do so? I cannot imagine.
You want to answer that, Sam, though? And then I want to hear what Reza's response to that is as well.
Well, I think that based on the facts that are generally known, that it is completely clear that the Iranians are on a path toward developing a nuclear weapons capability. And I think it's also clear that they're playing a game where they're sort of creeping up to that line in stages so that the final assembly process of that will occur relatively quickly. And I don't think there's any way on earth the United States can accept this Iranian regime armed with nuclear weapons and seriously think that we can, consistent with our own security obligations, tolerate that. I also think, by the way, it's moot because even were we to make the decision to tolerate that, the Israelis will not accept that. If that's where it comes to, the choice of who is, if we're really down to the choice ultimately, which I hope we never are, of a military strike, then it's really a choice between whether we're going to do it or the Israelis are going to do it, because they will certainly not stand by and let the Iranians develop it.
Reza?
The Israelis were told, we will stop giving you over $1 billion a year for weapons. We will stop vetoing every measure in the United Nations that might hold you accountable for your crimes. We would have leverage over the Israelis. They do not control the United States except by our own decisions. And the idea that a nation acquiring nuclear weapons, such as India or Pakistan or Korea, justifies going to war is new. There's something different about Iran. We're not bombing Israel. We're not bombing ourselves. Why must we bomb Iran because Iran acquires weapons when all of the proponents of war are quite clear that Iran's not going to use them if it has them? What sense can I make out of this?
Well, let me... Reza, go ahead.
If I can step in real quick.
Please do.
Because there's been a lot of good stuff that's been discussed here. So I want to make three quick points.
All right.
One, when we're talking about Iranian behavior and modifying it, are we talking about leverage that's needed to modify their behavior, or are we talking about actually addressing their interests and that potentially modifying their behavior? Because we've never had more draconian sanctions on Iran than we have now. The threat for war has never been higher than it is now. And the vast majority of reasonable Iran analysts in the United States and in Europe are saying that this is making the Iranian regime dig in its heels even more. This regime is ready for a fight. But ironically, it's not a fight that they want to pick. It's a fight that they feel is becoming increasingly inevitable. Again, right or wrong, this is their perception. And you know, if we're talking about issues of war and peace, then it's important to understand the mindset of the adversary. So building up enough what's called in Washington oftentimes building leverage to facilitate a behavior modification, it doesn't address the Iranian government's interests. And no negotiation can be successful unless you're doing something that – I mean, if you're giving something – if you're asking the Iranian government to give something up, you got to be willing to give something up in return. So then we have to ask ourselves, well, what are they interested in? And then make it the U.S. national security calculation on whether it's in our interests to address their interests. So that's one. Two, when it comes to convincing the Iranians to do something, whether it's on their nuclear program, support for terrorism, or anything in between, I think, again, we're talking about changing behavior or changing their strategic calculus. Because nothing we've done so far has changed their behavior. But more importantly than their behavior is their strategic calculus, because their strategic calculus guides their behavior, right? So if we want to change the Iranian government's strategic calculus and sanctions, Stuxnet viruses, and secret assassinations haven't done it, then the question becomes, well, what can? And I think that goes back to my first point, which is addressing their interests, or at least trying to, through negotiations. Because, again, negotiations, it's never too late to negotiate, as we learned during no other time than the Cold War. And the third point I want to make is about Israel. Israel is an issue that certainly should be discussed. It's an issue that weighs very heavily on the minds of U.S. decision makers, I know, as a former State Department official myself. So it can't be ignored. But I think that the Israelis, they don't want to fight any more than the Americans or the Iranians want to fight. What the Israelis are interested in is making sure that no other country in that part of the world has the same kind of technological and strategic advantages that they have. The Israelis are concerned that a country, whether it be Iran or an Arab country or anyone else in that part of the world, will have strategic parity with them, militarily and technologically. So the Israelis are focused on preventing that from happening. That's one of the foremost reasons why they bombed Iraq's nuclear reactor in the early 1980s, and that's one of the biggest reasons why we're hearing what, at least to date, has been largely Israeli bluster about bombing Iran's facilities. I mean, the Israelis have been saying for the better part of 15 years that Iran is 1 to 2 years away from a nuclear weapon, not a nuclear program, a nuclear weapon. Obviously a big difference between the two. So I think the United States does a very good job of taking Israel's concerns into account and differentiating the boy who cried wolf facet from the reality. And you're seeing a lot of recently retired and even currently serving Israeli government officials from the military, from intel, and political leaders who are saying, you know, it's not in Israel's interest to go to war with Iran, and Iran is not an existential threat. They are a security concern. And there's a big difference between the two.
So what would it mean, just for argument's sake here, what would it mean if Iran did have nuclear capabilities in terms of weaponry? I mean, the United States has them. Israel has them. North Korea has them to a degree. India, Pakistan, Britain, France. What would it mean if if Iran joined that very select club that many of us wish didn't exist at all? What would it mean if that happened, do you think, from your different perspectives? Go ahead, Sam.
Well, I mean, you know, for the purposes of shorthand, if you will, here, we keep talking about the Iranian government. And obviously, I think everyone who's followed the issue is aware that's glossing over some pretty significant differences. I mean, one of the problems of dealing with the Iranians all the time is that it's hard to figure out who's speaking for the Iranian government. We've seen that recently in just the last few weeks with threats to close the Straits of Hormuz, immediately followed by statements that they didn't really mean that and so forth. That's a pretty standard dynamic with the Iranians. So I say that by way of a caveat. Certainly within the Iranian government, there are significant numbers of individuals who I don't think that you can count on to behave as rational actors in possession of a weapon like this. When we dealt with the Soviet Union, for instance, with all of its issues, we were always able to deal with a relatively stable, methodical entity. Excuse me. The Iranians, at least some of them, have a very apocalyptic view and might not behave nearly as rationally in possession of that. No.
Okay, go ahead. You all right? Get some water. David?
Excuse me. I don't know how to speak to
that question.
Incredible hypocrisy. I mean, here we are. U.S. rest is the only nation that has ever used nuclear weapons. The nation that is building more nuclear weapons has more than anyone. It has a first strike policy. The Republican Party has apocalyptic views, but you know there is no reasonable analysis of Iran that suggests that Iran would use nuclear weapons, that Iran would attack the United States or Israel, that Iran is desirous of national suicide. I mean, so what would happen if Iran had nuclear weapons? Well, the great fear expressed by a number of proponents of war recently at the American Enterprise Institute was that Iran wouldn't use them. Iran would do the same thing every single other nation has done with them since Nagasaki. It wouldn't use them. And then that justification for threatening war on Iran would be gone. That justification for all of this fear-mongering would be gone. Iran would have nuclear weapons and not be using them. And so the fear-mongering is so hypocritical because the greatest fear is not that Iran gets a nuclear weapon and uses it. It's that Iran gets a nuclear weapon and doesn't, which is, of course, far, far more likely.
Reza?
I think that, let's unpack this a little bit. First, let's talk about rational, and then let's talk about weapon. I mean, it's very easy to throw around the term rationality in international politics and to say that, there are countries that do things that America doesn't like, and therefore they are irrational and they have apocalyptic politics and things like that. But I think that glosses over, a 32-year history of things that are eminently rational. If you don't understand a country's interests, then things that they do that don't jive with America's interests, they're going to seem eminently irrational. I get that. But, these guys are, sure, they're a group of cunning ideologues in Iran that are running the show, but they're not suicidal. So there are numerous instances over the past 30 years that demonstrate that they're highly rational, and their number one priority is survival, not a weapon. And on the issue of weaponization, we can say things like, this regime can't be rational, and a weapon like this shouldn't be in the hands of an irrational regime, but the National Intelligence Estimate, that is a consensus document of 27 U.S. intelligence agencies that was released in 2007 and again in 2011, stated unequivocally that Iran has not, in fact, made the decision to weaponize its nuclear program. That doesn't mean that the nuclear program isn't a cause for concern. It means that they haven't made the decision to weaponize. And if they haven't made the decision to weaponize, which is the consensus view of the U.S. government, both in Bush administration and the Obama administration, that means that there's time for diplomacy to try and change the Iranian government's strategic calculus and try to see if our interests can match theirs. And the only way to do that is to talk.
So let me open the phones here to our listeners, and I want to come back and really talk about some of the issues we've raised here, what it means that that the Iranian-American who has been found guilty of espionage and may be executed, the fact that that both Iran and the United States have had maneuvers that are threatening to one another, that if the price of oil is already inching up because of the sanctions and what could happen, and what it is that Reza was talking about earlier when you want to address what it is that Iran really wants and what do you think America really wants out of this, and if this is if there's a way to kind of intervene for someone else to intervene, or can there be an intervention that gives people what they want and lets things develop without a war. 410-319-8888 is the number here. We're talking with Reza Marashi, who is Research Director of the National Iranian-American Council, Sam Faddis, retired CIA officer who is President of Orion Strategic Services and author of the book Codename Aphrodite, his latest book, David Swanson, who's written the book War is a Lie, and Daybreak, Undoing Imperial Presidency and Forming a More Perfect Union. And Clarence, you're on the air.
Good evening.
Good evening, Clarence.
I'm Mr. Steiner and to your guests. I remember before Vice President Joe Biden became Vice President, he was on Face the Nation, and he was speaking in reference to North Korea. And his statement, quoting him, was, if you think about tipping a missile with a nuclear warhead, your regime is over. We will annihilate you. And I would think that the Israelis would take the same position. We will not allow you to have a nuclear weapon. That's just on the surface. But, however, here's my question. In the hands of, and this is not to insult anybody's religion or anything like that, but what is the possibility of nuclear weapons in the hands of Iran becoming in the hands of a radical faction of that religion in that country, or whereas it lead to what we would term as fanaticism? And if you look at it that way, then what are the possibilities of it occurring there as opposed to some of the other countries that already possess the weapons?
That's a question that's on a lot of people's minds, and let's go around the table with that. I mean, maybe I'll have different ideas. I have a feeling, Sam, you want to start us off, and we'll go to Reza and David?
Well, I mean, of course, we talk about the Iranians, we talk about the threat from the Iranians. One of the issues we need to consider is the fact that, you know, I mean, Hezbollah is largely a creature of the Iranians, not to say that, you know, it is not formed of other independent local Lebanese factors, but funded, supported heavily, provided with all kinds of equipment, provided with missiles. That is certainly a great danger, and one of the things that is considered in this whole calculus is, look, they have used Hezbollah on many occasions as a proxy to attack and kill Americans. Hezbollah has killed large numbers of Americans and other allies of ours. And, you know, whether they would or would not simply hand that weapon to them, that's not what I'm suggesting, but that is a possibility, that is a danger, that is kind of their MO, quite frankly, is to respond asymmetrically to actions that we take against them. So clearly that's one of the things that's on Washington's mind, is to look at this and say, listen, once these guys have this weapon, we don't really know where it's going to go.
And David Swanson, how do you see that in from your perspective?
You know, religious leaders in Iran have opposed nuclear weapons, have backed a nuclear-free Middle East. The only other non-nuclear nation in the axis of evil has been absolutely destroyed by the United States military. So you want to talk about a rational decision by a rational government in Iran. What you would predict would be a rapid course of developing nuclear weapons in order to avoid what Joe Biden may have threatened but not followed through with. On Korea. Iran, you know, has not attacked another country in centuries. Our nation has hardly paused to take its breath between attacks, you know, after overthrowing a democracy in Iran in 1953, backing a war on Iran through Iraq in the 1980s, providing weapons then and there that were used a generation later when they no longer existed to justify an attack on Iraq. I think that if we wanted to encourage a rational government in Iran, the hypothesizing for the moment that there is one, we would not be threatening and surrounding and badgering and sanctioning Iran. We would be talking to Iran. We would be using the inspectors. We would be allowing the inspections to work. We would cut the sanctions that are preventing Iran from developing wind energy and other technologies. I mean, we are not taking the course that you would expect if there were a chance of rational dialogue. Our government has written that off from the start.
Reza?
I think the question of radical religion and fanaticism, it's important not to extrapolate. Anytime you have a government in the world that does things that we don't like and, you know, there's a tinge of religion involved in it, we're very quick to throw that label around. And certainly it's a cause for concern. But again, I mean, let's unpack this, you know. We're talking about nukes, which Iran doesn't have, and the intelligence agency's consensus view in the United States is that they're not pursuing it. They haven't made the decision to do that yet. So nukes, which they don't have and they aren't seeking as of now, is they're game changer. Okay, historically, they are a game changer. And what does that mean? That means that historically, countries that have had these weapons, it usually moderates their behavior as a result of the principle that's called mutually assured destruction. Meaning, if Iran decides to get this weapon, and then they're able to make the scientific advancements to actually get it, which is, again, a hypothetical situation given the facts on the ground now, they know if they use this, then they're going to die. That's really what it means. It's going to be the end of the regime. And if we've learned nothing else since the contested elections in Iran in 2009 and the subsequent human rights abuses that have been taking place over the last 2 years, that this government prioritizes regime survival above all else. So it actually makes it more unlikely that that's the path that they would pursue, not the opposite.
So, Sam, go ahead.
Well, I mean, 2 points that I would make. First of all, I don't think it's an accurate statement that the intelligence community says they're not pursuing nuclear weapons. The assessment says, in effect, and I'll paraphrase, that first of all, this is not known definitively, but the assessment is that the regime has not made the final decision to weaponize, that is, to assemble a weapon, in effect. But all of the intelligence, including what the United Nations provided in its recent report, says that they're not just simply pursuing enrichment, but they're pursuing a number of other critical technologies whose only application is for a nuclear weapon, such as technologies that have to do with detonating a device, igniting the device, the ignition system of the device. And the second point I would make is this. I give you, having worked the problem over many years, a few years back I was having a conversation with a gentleman, an Iranian, who was assisting us, a senior individual, and we were discussing the issue of sanctions and so forth. And he expressed something that was very common to hear, which was a lot of skepticism about sanctions, but not from the standpoint of, you know, you need to talk to these guys, you need to be more reasonable with these guys, you need to try to accommodate them, from the standpoint of you're assuming that you're dealing with rational actors who want to find a solution. And in fact, many of these individuals, again, I'm speaking with broad brush about a government that consists of different pockets, but many of these individuals effectively believe this is the end of times, with similar parallels to the way in some Christian faiths denominations that's discussed. In other words, time is about up, and when the Mahdi, if you will, returns, we win. I don't care if we're going to be bankrupt in a year or in 18 months, or anything else. And I have no intention of you don't understand. I am waiting for the day when, effectively, to use the Christian term, Armageddon occurs, and we're going to emerge victorious. So, what he was attempting to say was, you're talking to individuals who fundamentally have a different worldview. And I'm not pretending that applies to every Iranian by any stretch of the imagination, or even to every person of prominence in the government. But, for instance, he was talking about Ahmadinejad when he was making that statement.
So we have to take a brief break, but I'm going to come back. I want to ask our three guests, and then we'll reopen the phones. Mitchell, you're the next caller up, and Andre, Darren, Michael are all waiting to get on this conversation as well on our phone lines. Each one of you was designing the policy for the United States, when it comes to Iran, given all the complexities of Iraq and Afghanistan and Israel and how we create a world where there is more peace than war, how would you design a policy now? What would you be doing? What would you be saying in the ear of those who make the decisions? I'm very curious to see what the three of you say about that when we come back. We can take a very brief break and come back with Sam Faddis, David Swanson, Reza Marashi, as we look at Iran, the United States, and our future. Will there be war or not? And is there a way to not have war and find dialogue? We'll be right back. Stay with us. Welcome back. Before we join our conversation, I want to remind you that WEAA invites you to the opening reception of our Zimbabwe Shona Stone Exhibition, Saturday, January 21st, 4 to 8 p.m. here at our WEAA studios. There'll be a gallery talk at 6 p.m. The exhibition is a courtesy of Zimbabwe Gallery. Colonel Thompson is the owner. Beverly Carter and Lewis Hudnell are the curators of the exhibit. And the exhibition runs through the end of February. For more information, call 443-885-3564 or go to weaa.org, and it's a magnificent sculpture exhibit, and I encourage you all to see it. Our guest who's in the studio, Sam Faddis, thinks the same thing when he walked in and saw it. So, and Sam Faddis is with us, retired CIA operations officer who served 20 years in the Middle East, South Asia, and Southern Europe. His most recent book is Codename Aphrodite. He's president of Orion Strategic Services. David Swanson is a peace activist. His most recent book is War is a Lie, and author of another book called Daybreak, Undoing the Imperial Presidency and Forming a More Perfect Union. And Reza Marashi is research director for the National Iranian American Council, 410-319-8888. I said we jump into this one question and reopen the phones, which is all three of you have different positions, but they're positions that do not fit into the position of the administration or the U.S. Congress of the moment. And I'm curious what you would be saying should be our policy now with Iran, and what steps could be taken? Where would we go from here if you were advising those in power? And for our listeners to understand, there are different ideas to do that. David, you want to start us off?
Well, I would note that the New York Times public editor today was forced to apologize for the false claim that the IAEA had found that Iran was pursuing a nuclear weapon.
I saw that.
They are not able to put over that claim anymore. I would also note that Iran and the United States are both parties to the Kellogg-Briand Pact, which forbids war. They are both parties to the Hague Convention of 1899, which requires taking this to arbitration in The Hague. I would point people to the map that's at don'tattackiran.org that shows U.S. military bases almost entirely surrounding the borders of Iran while we complain about the threat that Iran is to us. This is one conceivable approach. Start closing those bases. Start retiring from that region. Start apologizing for the threats and the false accusations made against that country, and see if perhaps the level of hostility decreases following that approach.
Interesting. Reza.
Well, I think you're asking the $64,000 question.
Yes.
And I admit that there's no easy answer, and I don't envy my former colleagues in the State Department at all, because for 4 years I was making Iran policy, and it's not easy in the least bit. But there are a few things that should be acknowledged and that guide us towards the direction that we need to go. Number one is that the 2007 and 2011 National Intelligence Estimate said that it judges with high confidence that in the fall of 2003, Iran halted its nuclear weapons program. So that's one. So operating on that premise, then we need to ask ourselves the question about apocalyptic politics. And I think that as it stands now, both Iran and the United States are playing a very dangerous game that's based on misperceptions. Each side is misreading the strength and the resolve of the other. So essentially you have a game of chicken where small errors in judgment can result in a military confrontation. And in game theory, the opponent that seems irrational or crazy can win. And that perception in Iran could heighten the danger. So what does that mean? This has been the underpinning of Iran's approach for the better part of 6 years. And it's also one reason why the Iranian system hasn't tried to contain President Ahmadinejad until recently. During my tenure at State, it was unmistakable that Ahmadinejad's image of being ideological and seeking to drive Iran into a war to expedite the hidden imam's return really crystallized within the Washington policymaking community. And few could understand why Iran didn't try to contain him to the degree that it has now, given how fragile U.S.-Iran relations had become. So Iran knows it's playing a risky game, but its self-confidence vis-a-vis the United States has, in my view, grown in a misperceived kind of way because it survived what it saw as 8 years of antagonism and confrontation from the Bush administration. And then you have widespread regional upheaval, which means that Iran is basically sitting and waiting for what it perceives to be appropriate U.S. moves towards dialogue. Now, how do you approach what Iran's interests are, and should you even approach what Iran's interests are? I think you have to ask yourself, what's the alternative? The alternative is essentially making the case for war, especially a preventive war. So how do you do that? First, you portray the supposed threat as dire and growing, and then you try to convince people that if we don't act now, horrible things will happen down the road. And all of this that requires is a bit of imagination and a willingness to assume the worst. Second, you have to persuade the people who you're talking to in interviews or writing to in articles that the costs and risks of going to war aren't that great. And if you want to sound sophisticated and balanced, then you acknowledge that there are counterarguments and risks involved. But then you do your best to shoot down the objections and emphasize all the ways that those risks can be minimized. So in short, in step one, you adopt a relentlessly gloomy view of the consequences of inaction. And then in step two, you switch to bulletproof optimism about how the war will play out. And I think that's essentially what we're seeing now circulating through the mainstream media. Again, you have diplomacy and you have war. Anything that happens between those two is a stalling tactic to kick the can down the road to one of the inevitable outcomes. So you need to sit down and you need to talk. And I think this is actually the consensus view inside the U.S. government, but it's silly season in Washington right now. We have an election coming up. So President Obama wants to look tough on national security, and the Iranians have an election, or more accurately, a selection coming up in March for their parliamentary elections. So they're trying to do the same thing. All politics is local.
Sam.
Well, first I'd say that, you know, anybody who's trying to make the case for the fact that war is going to be simple, easy, painless, whatever other adjectives we want to throw in there, has no idea what they're talking about and has obviously never been to war. So, you know, as I usually do, I'll preface everything by saying that anytime you find yourself thinking about going to war, the first thing you need to do is just go sit down, take a couple of deep breaths, and think of a few other options, because it's ugly and nasty and rarely turns out the way you intended. So I would certainly think that we should be attempting to avoid ending up in a military conflict with the Iranians. That said, to come back to, you know, my consistent theme, I don't think sitting down with the Iranians right now and engaging them is going to be particularly productive. I mean, all negotiation is about leverage, whether it's a business transaction or whether it's anything else. And I think that's sending exactly the wrong message to them. So I don't have a simple, neat, clean recommendation either. My recommendation would be we continue to tighten sanctions, and quite frankly, we continue to do all of the other things that we can do to inhibit the development of their nuclear weapons program, which we probably can't talk about in any detail here. And then we hope and pray that that and the divisions within the Iranian government are going to produce some sort of result where they begin to back away and show some flexibility, and we can end up in a situation where we can sit down and negotiate something. Because I certainly think the idea of, I mean, even if we're just talking about aerial strikes, there is no such option as neat, clean, surgical strikes, and now the problem is resolved and the sun comes out and everything's wonderful. I mean, it will be a mess.
Let me, gentlemen, jump into the phones here and come back. 410-319-8888. Mitchell, you've been waiting around a while. You're on the air.
Yeah, I'd like to reiterate what one of your pundits said from a quick historical perspective about the irrational behavior of Iran. I think that's from a philosophical prevailing prejudice. As one of your pundits says, Iran has not overthrown any government in the area or outside the area in modern times, whereas on the other hand, the United States has occupied Iraq and Afghanistan, went in and overthrew the government of Haiti, had hands in Honduras, and recently the president signed the National Defense Authorization Act. All these things of things that Hitler did during his time, preemptive wars, and people forget that he got the support of people like Henry Ford, people in other countries, Western countries, didn't have a problem with him because he was building Germany's economic system by himself, and he wasn't getting rid of all the war debts and things from World War One. And the thing about Iran, the idea that Libya and Iraq were overthrown because they didn't have those weapons. So it, in their minds, it might be, we need to make sure we have something because it seems that the countries that got rid of their prevailing weapons got overthrown. But the point I'm making is that United States says that this is a prevailing prejudice in light of not perceived things, but in light of the reality of who's doing what. Let's be clear about these things.
Mitchell, thanks for your comments. David Swanson, you want to pick up on that?
Well,
I'm sorry, Mitchell. I'm sorry, Mitchell.
Caller, I think it's critical to understand that we are not ideology free, that we have a Secretary of so-called Defense who pronounces Armageddon as the equivalent of reducing military spending to 2007 levels, even though somehow we miraculously did not end the world in 2007. I think it's important to see things from the other perspective, to imagine if Iran had bases along the border of Canada, along the border of Mexico, ships off our shore, ships sailing up the Chesapeake Bay, and the United States government was threatening to not allow those ships to sail up the Chesapeake Bay. It would be a very different perspective. Let's grasp that this is another nation of human beings, not of monsters, not of aliens, not of some other species, of human beings who are, if anything, more peaceful than we are, again, who have not attacked another nation in centuries. There are inspections. The inspections are working. The inspections worked in Iraq. They found no weapons. There were no weapons. Let the inspections work. Take this to arbitration in The Hague. Cease the illegal threats, cease the provocations, and begin projecting a different attitude of cooperation rather than domination to that entire region. And you will see a different response from these people, these human beings, in this other nation known as Iran.
So, and what I'm curious about both Sam and Reza, what David is saying, that the platform of seeking peace, and given that every nation and people sees the world from the perspective they sit in, as David was saying, what is wrong with what he's saying? I mean, what is not right with what he's saying? I mean, that we are, because right now, this is something, an article that just came through that I was just reading, just popped up on my screen as we were talking, where Dennis Ross, former National Security Council, says that Obama has made it very clear that regards a nuclear-armed Iran as a great threat to international security. The Iranians should never think there's going to be a reluctance to use force to stop them, he says, Obama says. Of course, he was secretary. He was on the NSC and, of course, Hillary Clinton's special advisor on Iran. He goes on to say there are consequences if you act militarily, and there's big consequences if you don't act. So, I mean, this doesn't sound very promising.
It's definitely not promising. As we started out, this is a difficult situation. There is no clear, simple way forward. And the possibility, as we're going forward with all the complexities here, of, as this unfortunately has happened many times in history, of us stumbling into armed conflict is very real. So we ought to be very worried about it. I would love to think that we lived in a world in which if we simply treated other, adopted this policy of exerting no pressure, no threats, no influence, and trust them to do the right thing, that's really the way the world worked. I think what you would get from the Iranians would be exactly the opposite. What it would be perceived as is weakness. And whatever discussions began would begin with them announcing that we already have assembled this weapon.
And I'm going to go back to the phone shows, I promised I would, but on the way back there, Reza, wouldn't it be madness? I mean, if war with Iran, what that would bring? I mean, A and B, if we put sanctions in, everything I've been reading, even from the people who believe in sanctions, would say that that would have a disastrous effect on the world economy. because of what it would do to the price of oil.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's been what's floating in the news for the last couple of weeks now, and the price of oil has been steadily rising just on the threats of different kind of military clashes between Iran and the United States. So if threats alone spike prices, imagine what an embargo or an actual armed conflict would do. But, you know, when it comes to the idea of war and oil embargoes and things like that, I think it's important to put all of this in its proper context. I mean, the larger U.S.-Iran conflict that exists is less about nuclear programs and more about the fact that Iran as a country in its current iteration, its current government, will not enter into the existing regional security architecture of the Middle East as it stands now. And that's very problematic for us, and that's very problematic for Israel. Iran will not become a compliant U.S. ally a la Saudi Arabia, Jordan, Mubarak's Egypt. They will not do that. And, you know, I think we should acknowledge that up front. What they are willing to do is to have conversations to see how they can potentially integrate themselves into a new or a different or a modified regional security architecture. And that's something that the United States has to decide whether or not it's in its interest to pursue, discuss, or implement. To date, we have said no, it is not in our interest to pursue a different regional security architecture. And in fact, I don't advocate a different regional security architecture, and I don't think we need to drastically change the security architecture in order to convince Iran it's in its interest to come into the architecture that exists now. And so when you have a country like Iran who prides itself on resistance to the status quo and instead seeks to change it, that's what makes its program, its nuclear program, so problematic. And that's what raises the cost of misperceptions and miscalculations. And that's what could potentially spiral into a military conflict.
Let's go back to the phones and let's see, we'll try to get a few more callers in the air. Darren, you're on the air. Pardon me.
Yeah.
Hi, Darren. Welcome.
Thank you. So there's a lot that's been said, but ultimately we have to, I have to look at things and say, does Iran pose a threat to the United States? And my answer to that is no. But we see Israel as an ally, and so maybe Iran presents a threat to Israel, our ally. But when but I'm having difficulty understanding why we consider Israel as our ally when earlier in the discussion, someone said that you know, Iranian proxies had killed Americans. Well, Israel had bombed one of our ships and killed Americans, and that wasn't a proxy, that was the state. So I'm just trying to understand the logic of why we would perceive someone if the threat of American lives is the litmus test, then why we would perceive someone who, you know, a state that has not conducted direct action against us as an adversary and a state that has conducted direct action against us as an ally is just bewildering to me. And I'll take your comments off the air.
Thank you so much, Dan, for your thoughts. And David, you want to pick up on that?
Well, the almost ludicrous thing here is that nobody is even suggesting that Iran is going to attack the United States or, you know, the homeland formerly known as the United States. And when you look at last week's announcement of military strategy for the future from Obama and Panetta and Gang, you had to go through 9 or 10 items of projecting power and controlling territory and space and cyberspace and the rest of it before you got down to any interest in defending the homeland formerly known as the United States. And so this is not about defense. And, you know, if there's anything crazy here, it's the United States' approach to this. We pushed nuclear energy on Iran in the 1970s. We gave Iran, the CIA gave Iran slightly faulty plans to make a nuclear bomb 12 years ago. In 2003, Iran was willing to negotiate with nuclear power and everything on the table, and the U.S. government said no. And since that point, we've had lie after lie after lie in the U.S. media pushing for a war with Iran. We've been told Iran's behind 9/11. We've been told Iran tried to blow up a Saudi ambassador in D.C. We're told Iran's not allowing the inspections. We're contradictorily told what the inspections are finding. We have a meeting, according to Seymour Hersh, in Dick Cheney's office, thinking up through how to stage a faked Iranian assault on a ship. I mean, there are people here who want a war, and we should stop kidding ourselves that war is the last resort and there just aren't any other good ones. War is the first resort of a lot of people in this mix, and we need to shake free of that.
So, I mean, I guess would either one of you disagree with that there are elements in our own government who would love to see a war with Iran?
I think that there are definitely elements in our government at all times who are way too quick to rush to armed conflict. Interestingly, most of those individuals themselves having never been to an armed conflict, but seem to find that it's a great idea to solve all sorts of problems.
Reza?
I completely agree. And I would say that the same dynamic exists in the Iranian government. And this is usually a dynamic that exists, whether it be in the American government, the Iranian government, or another one, in a minority fashion. I completely agree that if you've never served in a war before, or chances are you don't really know what you're sending your troops into. And to go to the caller's question, I would say, look, are we asking ourselves, is Iran a threat to the U.S. and Israel? I would say that it's not an existential threat to either country, but I would say that Iran poses threats to American interests and Israeli interests. And I think one of the biggest reasons why Iran presents a threat to our interests and Israel's interests is because they do things that we don't like, and we do things they don't like, and then we just don't talk about it. And so, look, you know, if we sit down and we talk for an extended period of time and conduct proper diplomacy the way that we do with most other countries in the world, and we still can't reach some kind of accommodation. Now, mind you, I didn't say rapprochement or modus vivendi. I just said some terms of agreement, some rules of the road with this Iranian regime as it exists now. Then I'll be the first person to say, you know what? We tried. We did it the same way we do it with the rest of the world. It didn't work. Back to the drawing board. But the fact of the matter is that hasn't happened yet. And I think that you have to exhaust all options before you get to the last and worst one.
This has been a really interesting discussion. I'm we'll have many more of these leading up in the next coming weeks and months as we hear these conversations take place about war and peace between Iran and the United States, and hope that the conversations we had all those year and a half leading up to Iraq don't end up in the same place. I want to thank our guest, Reza Marashi. It was a pleasure to meet you on the air for the first time. We hope to see you back with us again.
Thank you very much.
It's a pleasure to have you with us. Research Director for the National Iranian American Council, as always, is wonderful to have David Swanson with us. His latest book is War is a Lie, who is a social justice and peace activist in our country. David, always great to have you with us as well.
Great show. Thank you.
Thank you. And Sam Faddis, his latest book, Codename Aphrodite, former CIA officer, operations officer, and is president of Orion Strategic Services. It's wonderful to have you in the studio, and thanks for coming all the way up here today.
Great to be here.
And folks, those of you who didn't get in, well, next hour, I know you're going to want to talk with James Blue as he comes up, founder and executive producer of Public Affairs Media Group, who was a top producer for Ted Koppel in his years, an interesting journalist who is reporting live from New Hampshire. We'll talk about the Republican primary and then have a chance to talk with Jim Lehrer, who, of course, about one of the great founders and leaders of the NewsHour on PBS and has written a new book on the presidential debates. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Don't go anywhere.